Om Padram Karane Pishnu Yamadevaha Padram Pashe Makshabhirya Jatraha Stirairangai Istushtu Vagum Sastanubihi Vyashema Devahitanyadayuhu Swastina Indro Vudasravaha Swastina Pusha Vishwavedaha Swastina Staraksho Arishtanemihi Swastino Brahaspatirthadhatu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
I'll just review verse 15 in the chapter 3, and then we'll move on. Mirloha vispulingadhyayihi Mirloha vispulingadhyayihi Shrishtiraya charitanyata Shrishtiraya charitanyata Upaya sovataraya Upaya sovataraya Nasti bheda katanchana Nasti bheda katanchana Mrit Loha Vispulinga Adyaihi Shrishtihi Ya Chorita Chorita Anyata Upayaha Saha Avataraya Na Asti Vedaha Katanchana. Okay. The question is the Purvapakshi, the one who's raising doubts. His question is, you know, in the Upanishads themselves and in the first part of the Vedas, there's a lot of attention given to Srishti, to the creation, like the order of the creation, how the creation comes, the manifestation of the creation, a lot of drishtantas and examples about the creation. And so when you're saying that the tatparya, the reality, the essence of what the Upanishads are unfolding is Advaita, non-duality, then why all of this attention being paid to the creation, which is obviously dual? So maybe there's a non-dual Brahman and also a dual creation. So otherwise, why would the Upanishads be spending so much time dealing with it? And so here what he says is, the Srishti, that which is the creation itself, is discussed and is talked about and discussed in many different ways with examples such as mrit, such as the clay pot, for instance, loha, iron or gold, vispulinga, we use examples, I think it's in the Mundaka Upanishad especially, of sparks. You know, and these are drishtantas, illustrations for the creation. But these illustrations, like for instance, if we use clay, how clay itself is the material cause of the pot, right? Clay is the material cause of the pot. The iron or the gold, if we take low, it can be iron or gold. The gold itself is the material cause, the actual substance that is there for all of the bracelets and ornaments, right? The spark comes from Agni, the sparks come from fire. And so the tatparya, what is actually meant to be said, is we're dealing with this creation, or we're dealing with this creation because here we are. So how can we not deal with the creation? We have to go from the creation, this manifest duality that we experience, to what is its reality. So say we take a pot, and say we use clay, we take a pot, clay, pot, and from the pot we go to the clay, and then we show the relationship between the clay and the pot. Right? We have to start with the pot. If I hold up a pot, this is a cup. Right? What if I want to get to what this really is? I want to get down to the clay, for instance. I want to get to what it actually is. But I have to start with, and the Upanishad has to start with the actual experience that we're having. And the experience that we're having is the experience born of our sense perception. And so these nama rupas, these names and forms that we're experiencing, what we want to do is to be able to, experiencing these, take them step by step by step to the teaching methodology that's used in the Upanishad, to the recognition of the actual being of these things that we experience. So if I just stay with clay pot, What I have to do is to understand the relationship between the form. These are all forms, mm-hmm. right? I have to understand the relationship between the form and what is actually there. So the relationship between form and what is actually there is going to be the relationship between satyam and mithya. The form will invariably be mithya. Mithya means it has no being of its own. It is 100% dependent upon something else. And that's its content. And its content is going to be satyam. In the end, what is going to be satyam is that which cannot be broken down into smaller forms. Names within names within names within names. Because if it's broken down into smaller forms, for instance, if I take clay and I break it into shards, right? Then those shards are forms. Mm-hmm. Right? So in the end, I have to get down to what actually is the content. And what is the content must be formless. It must be formless, because if it's a form, I haven't gone far enough. Right? Because the form has to have a content, any form. And the relationship between any form and its content is the relationship between satyam and mithya. Mithya means it doesn't have any independent existence at all. And so, starting with this creation, there are many different methodologies that are being used when we start from the creation. Sometimes they even look at the creation as having five elements, which is what we're used to, space, air, fire, water, earth. Sometimes we just use the ones that have form, fire, water, earth. And they go through a whole unfoldment in that way. Sometimes they're looking at the panchakoshas. They're looking at the physical body and the prana. Physical body and then the prana and then the manas, the mind, and then the buddhi. And they're analyzing that way. Always we're analyzing the creation in many, many different ways, unfolding the creation in many, many different ways, always with the tatparya to reveal what actually this is. And what this actually is it like a non-dual satchitananda, mind being, conscious being. And so what he's saying here is that the Srishti is unfolded anyata in many, many different ways, using many different examples. Examples are drishtantas, like the clay pot, like gold chain, like spark fire, many different drishtantas. But all of these unfoldments are upayas. Upayas means upaya. Upaya means if they're means. They're a means of a taraya. Every one is a means to bring in something else, to resolve into something. Avatara means to bring down, to cross over. All of these are meant to, all of these drishtantas and the srishti is all meant to cross over into what is satyam, what actually is. Na asti bedaha katanchana. There is, in fact, no beda here. There is no duality here. That's the tatparya. Na asti bedaha. There's no duality at all here. There's a whole duality that we're experiencing, and all of the examples that we use and all of the unfoldments of the creation are unfoldments into non-duality, which is what every Upanishad is revealing. All of this that you experience here, this infinite manifestation of duality, is really a manifestation that of mithya, which has mithya manifestation, which has for its being your own one non-dual self, the one non-dual self that you are. And so this is what we have to see. You have to go from being a jiva, an individual, in this dual creation, to recognizing that this whole creation is nothing but you. The whole creation, including this body, mind, sense organs, has for itself this very simple non-dual presence, which is me. When I say which is me, I don't mean me, this body, me, this mind, me, this sense organs. But what I do, why I say me, Buddhists won't like this, it's problematic for them. But if you use it in the way that Vedanta uses, using these words as lakshanas that are pointing to something else, if I say me, let me just make this clear in the whole teaching methodology. When we start out, you come to the teaching, right? You come as this individual person. And so this me is this. When you say me, this conscious being that I am, it's this body, mind, sense organ sitting right here before you. That's who gets the me, right? But as we do this teaching methodology, what happens is everything that I had taken to be myself, this very personal self that I am, that is me, in fact, right, is differentiated from all of these things that, in fact, are objectified and belong to the creation. This body, which I take to be me, is actually, I'm aware of it through my sense organs. This body belongs to Ishwara, it belongs to the creation. It's part of the warp and woof of the whole creation. So are my sense organs. I'm also aware of them. They're part of this, they're part of Ishwara, they're part of the creation. All of my thoughts, part of the creation. All of my emotions, part of the creation. They're all coming and going, they're all objectifiable. Even the ahankar, the I thought, part of the creation. It's just a thought. It's a thought that comes and goes. All of my knowledge, all of my experiences, all of my relationships, part of Ishwara, part of the creation. These are all things that are objectifiable, that come and go, that I'm aware of. And so with this, as we start to go step by step by step by step, objectifying everything that can possibly be objectified, that I can have a subject-object relationship with every single thing, what am I left with after I've done that? I'm left with me. Just to drill it in a little bit more. When I meditate, we're relaxing, I was doing a meditation, when you welcome everything so that there's no resistance. You just welcome everything. When you're welcoming, you can't resist. It's the opposite of resistance. And then you just notice your own simple self, your own being. Who is that? It's not somebody else. That is me. That me is Brahman. That me is not limited. That me is the me, which is the self of the whole universe. In fact, what I wanted to do, I wanted to extend the meditation. I decided not to. I'll do it another time. When you're welcoming, you can start by, you know, as you relax your body and you just welcome all of the thoughts and all of the feelings, everything that's coming, all your worries, you welcome them. And if there's any people that are problematic for you, even in the past or in the present, you just welcome them. That's very interesting. Say there's an enemy. You have an enemy. You just welcome them. The enemy-ness of the enemy can't remain because there's none of the tension that causes the negative emotions. Negative emotions are tension. So when you're welcoming, what you end up with is an enemy person who doesn't have any of the qualities of being an enemy anymore. Right? You just welcome everybody. And then, you know, you can extend, you can welcome all of the beings that are suffering. I like to welcome all of the animals. I like to welcome all of the cows in industrial farming, and all of the pigs, and all of the horses, and all of the foxes, and all of the animals that are alone and suffering. All of the beings that are alone and suffering. They're going through all of this, but you can welcome them into your own. And then who are you welcoming them into? You're welcoming them into to Brahman. You can welcome the whole earth that's suffering right now, trying to stay alive. The earth is trying to stay alive now. The oceans are trying, the fish are trying to stay alive. They're fighting for their life. We can welcome all of them. You can welcome the whole universe. Because the whole universe. You know, why to do it? Bhagavan is already there. Brahman is already there as the very self of the entire universe. But when you welcome the whole universe, or you welcome the earth, or you welcome all beings, as you do that, then you know what it's like to be Brahman. Your mind is now much bigger, and all of it is welcomed into your being. And then you can just sit with that, sit with your being, you know, which is holding the universe. That's your welcoming. Welcoming means no resistance. Swamiji once, and this meditation really goes along with this thing that to me is a kind of another one of these mantras, Swamiji mantras. Swamiji said, you know, in the end, your heart has to be as big as Ishwara. It has to be as big as Ishwara, because all of this is Ishwara. All of it is Ishwara. But that means no rejection. That means there is a place for everything. Absolutely everything is welcome. And so when you do a little a meditation like this, you put your mind into that space where nothing, no one, nothing, even the little ones inside, you can even go there, the little ones inside, there is no one that is being pushed away that is not welcome. And so that puts your mind, that type of meditation, puts your mind into that recognition of the of reality, actually. And it's so beautiful, it's so peaceful. And if you do a meditation like this during the day or in the morning or throughout the day, just a split second, some of these meditations you can do in a split second. They're just a vritti, just all you need is one vritti. You know? And that keeps your mind in a very beautiful space. So it just brings the totality of your knowledge just into one little. If you practice it, you know, in your own meditative practice, then it can just, it's instantaneous. You can just bring it, and it wipes away all of the samsara. Gets rid of all the samsara. It's a good thing to do. When you do that, then you see there is no bheda. There's no duality of any sort. There is no duality at all. Let me explain. For you, when you have a thought or an image, say when I ask you to imagine a meadow, you can make the meadow so beautiful. You can have animals rolling around, walking around in the meadow, and you can have wind blowing, and you can have the sun, all kinds of things. You can all be camping there. We can have a really good time in our meadow. So much things can be going on there, right? But in spite of this very luxurious meadow, taking beautiful meadow and everything is there, it's your projection. It's your maya. There's no feeling that there's duality here, because the meadow is only me. It's only me, that's all. There's not two, there's not me in the meadow. There is only me. And this me is, you know, has this manifestation, mitya manifestation of the meadow, that has no being apart from me whatsoever. That's Advaita. That's non-duality. Non-duality isn't getting rid of the meadow. Non-duality isn't getting rid of the universe. Non-duality is the recognition that this whole universe is nothing but me. So you can start imagining a meadow, then you really understand what we mean by non-duality. But now imagine the universe, you know, and welcome the earth, welcome the universe without any resistance at all. You can start welcoming the people that you don't like and all of that type of thing to kind of get rid of those little tensions, you know. But then welcome the whole universe, and then that is, you recognize this is what we mean by Advaita, because you welcome all of it into your simple being, and your simple being is this me that is yourself. It is yourself. It is the self that you know to be you. You just didn't know that this me is the self of the whole creation, is the non-dual self of everything. That you didn't know, but you did know that yourself is this very simple, beautiful, conscious being that you are, that you identify with as you. Sometimes you get it confused with all of the tensions and whatnot going on in your mind, but when that settles down and you just notice your own meanness, that's the constant. That constant is Brahman. And so it's these type of, even the point of this verse is that all of this Srishti, all of this teaching about the Srishti, about the creation, all of the illustrations, the drishtantas that we are using, right, they're just simply there to make you understand this. That all of this that we experience has for itself, has for its truth, the Brahman, the self that I am. So that's why it's used. That's what these are for. Not to establish that the creation is real. That's the idea. So now let's go on to this verse 16. Ashrama trivida hina. Ashramas trivida hina madhyamot krishta drishtayaha madhyamot krishta drishtayaha upasano padishtayam upasano padishtayam tadartam anukampaya tadartam anukampaya ashramaha trivida. Then I broke this Sunday, as I broke this compound as we were chanting, just so I could do it in quarters, but actually it's one word. I broke here, so it goes.
Sorry.
It's one compound made of different words. So here are the words. Hina, Madhyama, Utkrishta, Drishtayaha. Then Upasana, Upadishta, Iyam. Ted Artam Anukampaya. Well, the question that can come here is, if everything's Advaita, non-dual, you know, and the Shruti says so many things like Shuddha Buddha Mukta Svabhavaha Eka, there's one Paramatma that is that is timeless and pure consciousness, absolutely free. Ekameva Adrutuyam, there's only one non-dual self here. All of these Shruti quotes are there, right? But then, with these Shruti quotes, all these Upanishad quotes, all of these beautiful quotes about the self being Advaita are there. But then there's also all of these things about doing Upasana, meditating on Upasana, doing different types of Upasana, subject-object. Maybe I'll do an upasana on Ishwara. There are many different types of upasana. Yeah. And the objector isn't dealing with nididhyasana. I'll get into that in a minute. There's also different karmas that we do, different upasanas. How can there be Advaita, non-duality? You say there's non-duality, and then you're telling these people to do these karmas and to meditate on, do these particular upasanas, meditating on Ishwara as different than myself. It's like if I do an upasana visualizing Shiva, the subject-object relationship, why are all these things there? It doesn't make any sense. So there can be some part Advaita and some part Dvaita. Dvaita, Advaita. A mix of Dvaita, Advaita. You know? Otherwise, I don't understand why all these things are brought out in the Upanishads. It's a doubt. I'll get to that later. So here he says like this. There are ashramaha trivida. There are three ashramas. Now, the way they're using ashramas here, it's like there's three types of people, three sets of people. Okay. There, one is hina, one is madhyama, one is utkrishta drishti. These three types, these three ashramas, are have their three drishtis. Means people have three visions. They see things in three different ways. One is more inferior, more lowly. One is madhyama, middling. And one is utkrishta, more exalted. What they mean by that is, so let me just get the rest of it, then I'll explain it more. The upasana upadishta iam. This teaching, the teachings of upasana. Upadishta means the upasana, this upasana, this which is the upasanas which are being taught, which have been taught or which are taught. They are tadartam for the sake of those, anukampaya, due to compassion by the Shruti. Mm-hmm. Out of the Shruti's compassion, these upasanas, different upasanas, are taught for those people who need them. Okay, that's why they're taught. It's not the tatparya of the Shruti. So here, this is what's the idea here. For anybody within, say, especially now in this context, for the Vaidikas, those people that are within the Vedic tradition, you know, there are those, they're all dharmis, they're all following dharma. There are those who, according to just their stage in life and their stage of maturity, what they really need is karma yoga. Yeah? And the performance of karmas, the performance of rituals, different saying prayers, different ways of worshiping the Lord. This is what is meaningful and satisfying to them. Okay? And also different types of upasana. Upasana is very good for chitta naischalya. Chitta naischalya means that's developing steadiness of mind. You know, like if I have an ishta devata, if I have an image of Bhagawan that is close to me, my ishta devata means that Lord, the image of the Lord that I feel most connected with. I can do an upasana on the Lord, you know, do pujas to the Lord, because it brings about that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. Ishvara Arpana Buddhi means that everything that I do is really, I do it as a worship to the Lord. And so that's, whatever I do, let that be pleasing to the Lord. Let that be pleasing to Bhagawan. I can go from there to where I see the Lord as the whole creation. Yeah. I can image the Lord as Krishna or Rama or Ganesha or Saraswati, whoever my Ishta Devata is. And I can do pujas to the Lord in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, whatever. You know. And I can, in my relationship with Bhagawan, I can say, let everything that I do, I lay at your feet. But everything I do is for you. And that's what brings about an antakarana shuddhi. Because now, once I do that, it's not for my raga dvesha. I'm not doing this to satisfy my likes and dislikes. That's not why I'm doing it. I'm doing it for dharma. And that dharma is my arpana. That is my worship of you. So let everything I do, what is the motivation, is only dharma. And so all of my actions I lay at your feet for your prasadam. Or I can see everything as Ishvara. If I gain more knowledge, I see everything as Ishvara. I'm still a karta, I still see myself as a doer, but all of this is Ishvara. And then, again, Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. Everything I do is an arpana, a worship of Ishvara. And what is that? How does that? What do I mean by that? Everything I do is only dharma. I only do dharma. That's all I care about. I don't care about raga dvesha. It doesn't matter to me. I don't need to fulfill. I'm not living to fulfill my desires. I don't want to fulfill desires so that I can be happy. I want to do dharma. Because the dharma gives me something that is much greater than the sensory pleasures from fulfilling sense. So it's not any longer, my life is no longer about getting this or getting that or not getting this or not getting that. It's about every situation I see as Bhagawan. And I do what needs to be done in that situation. With that type of Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, everything is a worship of the Lord, everything is Dharma. Then how can I help? For I'm doing all of that for Antakarana Shuddhi. Then there's another level, say, where I'm only doing Nitya Dhyasana. It's not Ishwara Arpana Buddhi now. I see all of this as Ishwara. I see all of this as my being. That's Advaita. And so now what I'm, of course I'm only doing Dharma. If I'm not doing Dharma, there's a sadhana to me. Right. Then there's something going on that I have to deal with. That's a sadhana. But I'm doing Nitya Dhyasana where I continually am just owning all of this as Brahman, which is my being. That's a type of Nitya Dhyasana. In the Bhashya, Shankara has the Purva Paksha, looking even at Nitya Dhyasana as Upasana. Nitya Dhyasana is not Upasana. Nitya Dhyasana is where I'm resolving everything into conscious being. It's Advaita. There's no subject-object relationship in Nitya Dhyasana. I'm using all of the knowledge that I've gained, and sitting with that knowledge, I'm resolving everything into Ishwara. Into the self. There is no separate self. Upasana, there's still a separate self. But until the karta, this doership, this ahankara has been resolved, I do upasana. I do karma yoga. Because karma yoga and upasana and that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi brings about a antakarana shuddhi, a pure mind. A mind that's free of raga dvesha and a mind that's totally available for this knowledge. So that karma yoga resolves into Nitya Dhyasana. Karma yoga, that karma yoga buddhi resolves into Advaita. And so what Gaudapada is saying here, there are different levels of vision that one has when one comes to this knowledge. Before one comes to this knowledge, the Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, where I'm worshipping the Lord either as my Ishta-Devata or I'm even seeing the Lord as Ishwara, and but the karta is the subject-object is still there. You know, I do upasanas, I do prayers, I do all of these things. It brings about that shanti in the mind. You know, that peace in the mind that will later resolve into Advaita. And so there's levels. There's levels that we go through in our maturation process. The light of this knowledge. And the Shruti covers all these levels out of compassion. It doesn't just say, you're Brahman, go in peace. Advaita, this is all mithya, you're satyam. You know? No. It takes you from wherever you are and whatever your needs are, step by step by step. That's why usually in the Upanishads, the first chapter, or the first part of the Upanishads will be for the Uttama Adhikari. Uttama Adhikari means, Adhikari means the student, qualified student. Utta means the highest. That student is just needs to hear a few things and then they can walk away, they're fine. So the first part of the Vedas just gives the knowledge. The first part of an Upanishad. The second part will give a little bit more of things that you can do to help the mind mature, right? And the third part will give a little bit more, you know, things to do if you're still having some trouble here and there and the mind, say the mind is restless or this or that. These are things that you can do. It brings all of these things together because it just wants to take you, you know, step by step by step to a mind that totally owns this knowledge. And that's the Shruti, that's the mother Shruti. So it's just like you have a child. First you have to teach the little one to be able to crawl. And then they have to walk, you know. And then they get to run. And then they get to grow up. So step by step by step, knowing very well what all minds need and what the process of maturing is in the light of this knowledge for a mumukshu or somebody who's living within that Vaidika Dharma. What is that natural flowering, you know, of a dharmi, with a person who's following in Dharma? What is the natural flowering into really being able to own this knowledge? And so he's just giving three ashramas, three groupings here. You know, you understand what I mean? The drishti from a less mature drishti to a middling drishti to a more mature drishti. Drishti means vision, seeing. And so out of compassion, that's why all of these upasanas and karmas and things are done. It's not that those are the top parya. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's upasanas, so there's duality. No. There's upasanas that involve meditations, that involve subject-object relationship. Therefore, you know, there's duality. Or the Shruti wouldn't be talking about it. There's all of these karmas and rituals. The Shruti wouldn't have these karmas and rituals, right? If it was everything was non-dual. You don't need these things when there's only one non-dual Brahman. These things are, you know, meaningless. But the Shruti has them, so they must be real. Right? So therefore, we must have Advaita and Dvaita. Somehow, some kind of mix here going on. And so, no, it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with giving you what you need to gain the maturity and the antakarana shuddhi, that purity of mind, to be able to see this, to recognize it. Because the Upanishad is a means of knowledge for the mumukshu who, sitting here amidst all of this duality, wants to know what's going on. Right? We're sitting here in the middle of it all, right? So the Shruti is not going to just say it's all satyam nitya, don't worry about it. That's not enough. You have to see it. You have to be it. You have to know it completely. And it's not it's intellectual in that you use your mind, but it's not intellectual in the sense of being indirect, like book learning or a catechism. Because you are here. Advaita, what is non-dual, is here. Non-dual means one without a second. It means there's no room for anything else. And you must be that. Right? If the reality is non-dual, then you are that or you're not here. Right? I have to be able to say, this is that, this is that, this is that, this is that. There is nothing that is not that. Therefore, I am that. Right? Non-dual means there's no parts. There are no parts. So we see all of these parts, but these parts are only have one being, one substance. And so the parts are mitya. There are no real parts. It's like Swamiji uses the example sometimes, if you have a big clay relief fresco, you know, where you take a big block of clay and you carve into it an intricate, very intricate scene. It could be a city scene with all kinds of people and bullock carts and everything going through. In this big block of clay. And so with all of that very clearly carved out duality, there is no duality at all. There's only one non-dual clay. That is Advaita. These lines of demarcation mean nothing compared to, in reference to what is actually here. The lines of demarcation are not demarcating being. Right? So you can't, if you draw a line through being, the line is in being, right? So it's just like that's why we use the illustration of space. The illustration of space is so beautiful as a drishtanta, right? Because everything moves in space, right? Space is all pervasive to the situation, so. What time is it? 22? Okay, let's stop there. It's good enough. I'm just supposed to take the job in. Let's take a moment. Swasti Prajabhya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Go Brahmane Vyashubhamasti Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Pavantu Kale Varshati Parajanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Kshobarahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukkha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamada Purnameva Vashishate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Is Upasana any kind of meditation or just visualization?
The upasana, usually upasana, we've got dhyanam, upasana, iridhyasana. Upasana usually means the meditation on something other. So this, so it'd be a meditation on the form, some form, usually some form of the Lord. Yeah. And but there can be kind of a complicated upasanas also where there's steps to the upasana. But the idea is that, that there's a subject-object relationship. And even if I'm meditating on a form of, like an Ishtadevata, I will visualize that Ishtadevata to the point of actually merging with the Ishtadevata. But I'm merging, it's as though I'm merging with something other than me. Whereas in Nididhyasana, I'm recognizing that the this conscious being that I am is Ishvara. Or I'm recognizing this self as Brahman, which is Ishvara, or I'm just resolving my mind, you know, into conscious being itself. So there's no subject-object differentiation. There's a resolution of subject-object differentiation. But in Upasana, there's still the karta, the doer, and the upasaka, and the upasya. The upasaka is the one who's meditating. The upasya is the thing you're meditating on. But in Nididhyasana, right, the one that you're meditating on is your own being.
Well, if
so there's a resolution.
If you choose Dakshinamurti as your
Ishtadevata,
but that's the message he gives to you, that you are one. So
yeah.
you do it doubles up kind of.
It kind of, that's a beautiful say of Dakshinamurti, which is for in the Arsavidya with Swamiji. Dakshinamurti is our Ishtadevata, because first teacher. So you can do an upasana where you're visualizing Dakshinamurti and the whole story of Dakshinamurti, and you see his mudra, and he has his foot on the ahankara, and it's very beautiful. Or you can visualize the Dakshinamurti that we have at the temple in Coimbatore. And then there's a relationship there. There's the devotee, you know, and the Ishtadevata relationship is very beautiful. And then you can have a Dakshinamurti teach you.
Yeah.
And then in that teaching, it becomes Nididhyasana, because you leave him behind and resolve into the self that he's revealing to you.
Because that won't necessarily happen if you pick another deity, right?
Well, it can. It just depends on what you do with that deity and what your knowledge is. You can have the deity, you know, whether you have an Ishtadevata beautiful relationship with that deity, and then you resolve it into Brahman, to yourself.
Mm.
You can do that too. Mm. But say you don't know that, so you don't have that knowledge, then it's a devotee relationship, which is also very beautiful, because it gives Antikarana Shuddhi to the mind. It's where there's Ishvara is more important. Ishvara is the focus of your attention. Or it might be easier for you to think of it in terms of Dharma is the focus of your attention. You know, if you don't relate to Ishvara and Ishtadevatas and all this type of thing, you can relate to Dharma.
Is it helpful to have an Ishtadevata, and can you pick your own? Can it be a Western
yeah,
one
it can.
As opposed to?
It's helpful if it's helpful for you, because people have different orientations.
Not everyone's been to India and has that inculcated in their psyche.
Yeah, and some people have a god phobia because of the West. Yeah. It's kind of a... When I first started teaching here this many years ago in the 70s, and a lot of Western students, I could not bring myself to say the God word. I was so uncomfortable. Because I could say always say Ishvara. Even now, God, the word doesn't register well with me. Well, Ishvara is fine. You know, Ishtadevata is fine, Ishvara, Ganesha, all of them are fine. There's no problem. But that this G-O-D word... Because
it's polluted.
Too much resistance.
Yeah, there are too many problems with it growing up and whatnot.
How do you answer somebody who asks you, do you believe in God?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, what I'll usually say, you know, that's a very difficult question to answer because
yeah.
I have to understand what you mean by God first.
Well, they're coming from, let's say most of them are coming from Christian backgrounds.
Yeah. Then I don't know. That's a difficult question because even if they're coming from a Christian background, what they mean by God can be so many different things. Like when I asked my mom, she laughed and said, "Well, honey, I guess I still see the white robes and the
long
angel wings and the beard." And she said, "I know that's silly, but that's what
yeah.
I see."
Well, they're still, you know. They're still coming from duality.
Oh, yeah, totally.
No matter what. So, again, how do you answer it? You know.
You have to define your epistemological terms before you can have that conversation or it's hypnosis being passed back and forth.
You know, this idea of welcoming so that the mind stays peaceful and doesn't resist. What if there's something... in yourself that you're not very...
you can't do that.
Huh? Yeah, you can't do that with you. Something about yourself that you don't appreciate very well and you don't want to welcome, you know? You want it to push it away.
Yeah, then those are where we can get into really beautiful conversations. In fact, we can take that meditation farther where the ones that you find you can't welcome, then we put them over in their own room, okay? They go in their own room. And then you've done that welcoming to so many things that you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are certain ones that need more attention. And then that's when you can bring those people in one by one and really have a dialogue. I'll do those too.
But
yeah, we've done those before.
But does it disturb the whole process of welcoming if there's a few dark holes in it?
Well, it disturbs a little bit, but that's what in the sense that you note it. I wouldn't take it as a disturbance. I'd take it just as a fact. So these things are not available for you to welcome because there's still too much hurt there or whatever. There's still too much there, so you can't bring yourself to welcome them. But then we work on those one by one. You know. If you know how in the Bhagavad Gita there's that beautiful verse where Krishna says, you know, there's three types of desires. And now when you think of desire, think of your raga dvesha, think of obstruction, really. Desires and obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because if you have a strong desire, then too many things can go wrong. Especially, a strong desire means it's not fulfilled. So, anyway, some of these desires or things that pass through that could be irritants, you can just blow them away like smoke. Just let it go. Those kinds you can easily welcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those irritating people, irritating situations, whatnot, you can welcome them, and then they can be before you and realize there's nothing there. Then there's some that they're more likened to dirt on a mirror. It's an irritant that you can't just welcome. Your mind doesn't want to.
But you can handle it.
You can be with it a little while and you can get it. But there's some that are like a fetus. And your mind just says, no, no, I can't deal with this. Okay. And so those then we need to give some special attention to those. A lot of kind of dialogue work, and it's not like that you can't bring that person to be before you, you know, but then there has to be some sort of conversation, guided meditations and conversation that can be really helpful, but they require special attention. In fact, it's good to practice this welcoming, because most of the time you can do it.
Yeah.
There's going to be maybe a handful of things that are not going to let you do that. But then those stand out. And then those are important ones that you can work on in ways that you can slowly chip away at that resistance.
Because when you push something away, you lose your center and you become kind of an individual again, because you can't take that as a separation.
Yeah. When you have to push it away, it's very painful. But at least you get a feeling of where you're, you know, where the resistance is. And something to, it's there, something to work with. Like you can let that person come in front of you just internally, you know. And you can say, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't welcome you. I would like to be able to welcome you, but I can't. And you can talk about it. I can't welcome you because you've hurt me so badly, or whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm. You've done this, this, and this, you know. And then they can tell you their side of the story. It's very interesting what kind of conversations, internal conversations you can have. Because, see, what you're suffering from doesn't exist outside. It's not out here. The person that you're suffering from is inside. It's not the physical person out here. So it's the person that you've interjected. It's a real person, but you've interjected them, part of them, that is in conflict with you. Yeah? And since the problem is internal, you can talk to that one who's internalized. Because that's much more effective, in fact, I would say, than talking to the physical person. Because the physical person is not the one you've internalized. See what I mean? Like, you don't internalize a whole person, you internalize only the part that's been problematic.
Yeah.
And you know, like, have you ever seen, like, somebody who is a huge problem for you, you see that person laughing and carrying on with their friends and whatnot, and these people like them, and what is this?
How dare they like them?
But it's because what you've internalized is the very negative part that has hurt you, right? So it's that one that you need to come into relationship with and work it out with inside, because it's not outside. It's not. And that's why sometimes working it out outside is not all that helpful.
Yeah. It won't solve what you're working with.
Yeah, not necessarily. Not necessarily.
Yeah.
So I think it was yesterday you said something that seemed really important. You said that the Neo-Vedanta movement has a different vision or approach to their development, where they hear a lecture, they don't necessarily get it during the lecture, then they go meditate to get it. To get the understanding in the meditation.
Yeah, that's and we're talking within the tradition.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. there's the Shankara and Ratnaprabha, there's a different line where the Upanishads, I'd say this is the most traditional line. The Upanishads themselves are a teaching methodology, a pramana, a means of knowledge that deliver the goods. While you're being taught, mm-hmm. you see, when you get to see, you get it, and you get it, and you get it, and you see, you right. understand. Then your contemplation, your nididhyasana, is on what you've understood. Then there's another where the emphasis is, but the same teaching is taking place, right? But then you have to go and meditate to understand it.
Mm.
You see the difference? So
and you're not getting
one is looked at more like a lecture that you understand, and then you go meditate and try to realize it. Or Shankara, the tradition that I'd say has the most strength. So these both are there. Is that the Upanishads themselves are a teaching, a means of knowledge, and then because of the Dehatma Buddhi, there's some and the identification of such a strong that identification of the self with the body, right? And just habitual thinking, habitual ways of thinking. That you use nididhyasana to just, it's almost slowing down the shravana. Shravana is the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And just being with it, you know. And seeing what you've, sitting with it, giving the mind a chance to just sit with the knowledge that you have. You know. Because we have all this coming in at us and all this habitual thinking, so you have to give it some time. But I think having a contemplative practice, you know, in the morning, and then have little throughout the day, you get used to just bringing your knowledge back. You know. Like that's why if we do an Upanishad, like the Mandukya Upanishad, in the end you can just say Om and it brings the whole thing back, because the whole Upanishad is an unfoldment of Om. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But you could have just any simple saying or simple mantra, anything that just brings your mind right back, you know, so that you get used to helping the mind when it's getting, you know, lost in the storm.
Yeah, I like to. Michael said this several weeks ago that I'm still here.
Yeah, that's
remember
a great
that?
One.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a good one.
All the stuff's going on. I'm still here. Wow, that's amazing.
Well, I asked the question to Carol. Suggested, am I still here?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes.
Yes.
Always.
Yeah. And you start realizing, and the one who's still here is the one who is always here. That is Brahman.
Yeah.
The one who is never gone, can never be changed. No, you can't do anything. It is always here. And once you recognize that that's the me, in fact, and that me is Brahman. And in meditation, that's the one that's here. There's nothing you can do ever to change it.
This last verse, the one we just did, 16.
Mm. Yeah.
It was so interesting because I feel like I've asked that question all the time to myself. About, like, I feel like a lot of the meditations and a lot of the prayers that are subject-object and dual, like, I find it, like, I worry that it's confusing to me.
Uh-huh.
Like, if I'm trying to understand something that's non-dual, why keep bringing up these images and prayers and stuff?
Yeah. It's for antakarana shuddhi.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, antakarana shuddhi, getting the mind very oriented toward dharma for something that's higher than just your raga dvesha.
Yeah.
You know? And also, you live here, right? You have this, as long as you are alive, you have this body, mind, sense organs, you are related here. And so it's orientating your life here in a way that supports this knowledge. It is a good precursor to this knowledge. And then when you gain this knowledge, all those attitudes remain. It's not like the knowledge. You gain knowledge and those attitudes, that dharma, and recognizing, that doesn't go away. It's just you recognize that it's all your own being. It converts into a dvaita, but everything remains the same except that it's converted into it.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't really skip that part.
No. No, because you are here.
Yeah.
Right? You're here as a body, mind, sense organs, jiva, who's living in this world. And
well, once you already know the truth of it, it seems silly to be like, keep telling yourself that there's this God that's separate from me.
You wouldn't keep saying there's a God that goes away.
Yeah.
There's Ishwara, but it's not separate from me.
Yeah.
There's Dharma, it's not separate from me. Like the whole Ishwara is I am Ishwara. But the Dharma, the way of appreciating this whole creation as Ishwara, that stays exactly the same. But this God separate from me goes totally away.
So that's essentially you're worshiping yourself.
You're worshiping yourself, though, when you use that type of language, it so easily converts back into an egoistic statement. So you don't want to say like that.
Okay.
You know, it's when you recognize that this self is Ishwara. That's maybe a better way to say it. You recognize that this very self is Ishwara, is Brahman.
There's also it seems to be this tendency on Westerners. I know I definitely experienced it where once you get into non-duality and are exposed to it, then seems to be like this desire to kind of wholesale just get rid of all other metaphysical stuff that you've learned and just somehow recant it all. But it's not necessary to do that.
You're only going to recant things that aren't true.
Okay.
You know, like to say, if I say this is all mithya, that doesn't mean it's not true. It means it's mithya. It's
not independent.
Yeah, it's not independent at all. You know, but here it is. It has an objective reality. It has its own laws and whatnot. And so the thing is to be, to understand it as Ishwara in a way that's appropriate, in a way that works. Something that is true, everything supports it. You can do whatever you want, but it won't break it because it's true. If it's not true, it'll go crashing. That's the great thing about Vedanta, the Upanishads. It is true, and you can do everything you want to try to prove that it isn't. That's a good thing. Everything. No holds barred. To try to prove that it's not true. Try to come up with something better. Try to find the flaw. To whatever degree that you want. You're free to do that, and that gives the mind, the buddhi, tremendous freedom. It doesn't have to be tiptoeing around and, you know.
Worried about a violation.
Or worried about, yeah, some violation, or that you have to tiptoe, you know, or the answer will be something like, well, you have to take that on faith.
Hmm.
That's not going to be the answer. You have to take that on faith.
That's what's great about this teaching is because it's, as he saying, some people say, just go meditate on it. That's not going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you want the answer.
You want the, your mind wants to understand.
Yeah.
There are some things that you have to take on faith, but you don't have to take them. You know, like for instance, that there's reincarnation, that there's seven lokas up, seven worlds down, that there's devatas, the whole cosmology. It's beautiful to understand how they lay all of that out. But you do have to believe that, because in order to know that it's true, you're going to have to die and go up to those lokas. But those type of beliefs, which actually resonate with me emotionally, I have no problem with them at all, and I like them. You know, I love them, except it's not a problem for me. But it's not in the way of my knowledge, one way or the other, you know. But certain things that the Vedas say, I take them because the Vedas say it, and it makes emotional sense to me and logical sense. But that's not the way that knowledge works in reference to self-knowledge, to knowing yourself, because yourself is here. It's not a way. No. Ishwara is here. It's not a way either. Ishwara is this. Satyam Mithya is here, direct, immediate. But these other lokas are take place in time and space. Mm-hmm. And so they're away. So you can say, well, the Vedas say there's these other lokas and this and that.
So this, if it's here, then when you say, I am all of this.
Yeah.
That is here?
That is here. Look at it like this. There's such a thing as infinite extension, so it's important to kind of understand this. If I can say that myself is yourself, is one, mm-hmm. then myself is the self of everything. If this one thing is true, then it's true all the way across, or this can't be true. Because there's no way that myself can be yourself if anything about you that is objectifiable, right, is yourself. Because you're over there and I'm over here, right? So then that's true for the whole creation. I've liberated my being from the entire creation. But I've liberated it from space and time also, because space and time are objectifiable, so conscious being doesn't have space or time.
Mm-hmm. So that resonates, but then it doesn't resonate so much to be able to say, I am all this.
Well, now we have to go out in this and see if there's anything here. And when you start analyzing to try to find something here, you can't find anything because everything is infinitely divisible. It goes into an infinite regress. You can't find a thing here. You can only find mithya here. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Because you can find forms here. Mm-hmm. Also, the sense perception is limited also, that you're only being able to look at the surfaces through sense perception, not the substance. You are the substance. You perceive, even with sound, you perceive the surfaces. You are the content. You can't perceive the content. That's kind of using different language a little bit.
Because if the pramana does its trick and we realize that we aren't these things.
You have to realize that you are these things.
Then we realize that's to the point of why the rituals and the projection into an image of God or something like that. Isn't in once realization has happened, those things aren't necessarily discarded.
They're not discarded if you enjoy them.
Right, they're there.
Yeah, but you enjoy them, but they're you understand them in the context of the whole.
It's a different thing, but it's still there.
It's still there.
Still here.
Yeah, but a lot of people, some people, if they have knowledge, they continue doing their contemplations and they have their Ishtadevata, and some people don't. But the people that don't probably didn't have much of that before anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, they're more just intent on studying. In fact, I used to be only studying.
You've come more to it.
Yeah, now because I just love it. It's because it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But it's not that all of a sudden I've become, you know, a Dwightan.
Real evolution.
When you were answering my question at the beginning, you mentioned three types of meditation, and the third one was dhyana.
Dhyana can go either way. It's a bigger form. It's like a catch-all. Dhyana. Okay. When you're talking about meditation, you can be talking about upasana or about nitya dhyana.
And dhyana refers to both of them,
yeah.
Or one or both.
I think we're done now. Are we? Well, I'm kind of used to this already.
Say, if you say so. Yeah.
We've got this new thing now.
It's working out pretty well.
I'm not quite used to it, but yeah.
How do they like it?
Let's see. There are loud... I don't know. Let's see. We've got some notes here. Hang on, everybody.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
You want to push that up a little so you can see more?
Yeah, I'm trying to get the line there.
Yeah.
That's cool.